Hi, this is Douglas McGrath. I'm the author of Beautiful, the Carole King musical, and I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, shalom to every one of you from every one of me. This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon, lover of humor and lover of theater and music. And we're combining all of that right now because the guest that we are talking to is a filmmaker, he's a writer, he's a librettist even. His name is Douglas McGrath. Okay, so he's not Jewish, but he works with Jews. He wrote the book for that big hit musical on Broadway, Beautiful, the Carole King musical. He also collaborated with Woody Allen on both the movie and the Broadway musical, Bullets Over Broadway. He directed a few documentaries on HBO, including one about Mike Nichols. He's also wrote and directed the movie Emma with Gwyneth Paltrow, the half-Jewess. So lots of Jewish things to talk about and other things to talk about with our guest in the neighborhood, Douglas McGrath. Welcome, oh shalom to you.
Shalom to you too. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. It's delightful to have you here. So when did you realize you wanted to be a writer?
You know, I thought I wanted to be an actor, but then when I was at college, I started writing plays. And I thought, oh, this is much nicer. You can sit. You don't have to wear all the stuff on your face. I loved it. It just kind of fit better. And I was not really a very good actor, and I really loved being a writer.
But you chose plays as opposed to maybe short stories and novels because?
Well, I think there's nothing harder than a novel.
Oh, yeah.
Really.
Well, torture. Torture is a little bit harder.
Well, there's nothing harder. Harder to...
Building a housing complex. But yes, okay, yes.
Well, you know, in a novel, if you're writing a novel, you have to describe the couch, you have to describe the lamp, everything. If you're writing a screenplay or a play, you just have them come in, and then somebody else makes the couch. They do everything, and the people just talk. And I like the way people talk, so I was best for a field based on dialogue and conveying a story through dialogue.
Now, do you ever look back at the first play you wrote? Was it any good? Did you think it was good when you wrote it? Did you know it maybe was not so good?
I think it's... my friend Woody Allen often says to me, don't look back. Just keep going. Don't look back. If it's good, you'll think, why am I not doing this now? And if it's bad, you'll think, oh, what was the matter with me then? So I really don't look back much.
Thank you for name-dropping right there. So it precludes me from having to introduce the fact that you have not only worked with, but you are longtime friends with Woody Allen, and yet you met through kind of mutual friend women sort of things, right?
Well, we met through my wife.
Well, there you go.
Who is a woman.
Yeah. I hope she's a woman. Well, no, in this day and age...
Oh, you know, you got to be clear now.
Yeah.
But she, Jane, my wife, had worked for Woody for many years and then had stopped working for him but had remained very good friends with him. And then when she and I started to date, I got to know Woody.
And is he knowable or is there something basically always mysterious and kind of not knowable about him?
No, that's the great surprise of Woody, for me anyway, was that he is both somewhat like you would expect in that he puts a lot of himself into his movies so that there's a recognizable quality to him. And yet, he's not at all like his screen image. You know, he's not only his screen image, but in fact his kind of public relations image, which is often a very sort of intellectual and art-minded person. But at the dinner table, he's just a regular fun guy. He talks about what's in the newspaper. He talks about the ball game. Have you seen this movie? He's one of the easiest people I know to talk with. And he has that rare quality, I think, which is that he is every bit as good at listening as he is at talking. And I'll add this one other thing. Unlike many actors, and Woody is a terrific actor, but he is not only an actor by any means, and I don't think he thinks of himself as an actor first. I think he thinks of himself as a writer and a filmmaker first.
Right.
Unlike many actors and stars who can only talk about themselves and who go kind of dead if the subject is not themselves, he's intensely curious about other people. Wants the conversation to be about the other people at the table, to hear what you think or what you're doing. I find him very generous that way.
Well, I think that shows up in the movies. You couldn't make 40 movies about the intricate details and behaviors of people the way he does if you're not intensely curious about the thoughts and behaviors and what are they really thinking, how are they really behaving. If you're just looking in the mirror...
I agree.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry to interrupt, but
no, please.
Notice, if you notice, in his movies, there are certain types that repeat, and yet there is a range of characters in his movies that you would never think, in some ways, the same person could have written. You think of Annie Hall, the character of Annie Hall.
Right.
Then you think of Broadway Danny Rose. But also, not only Broadway Danny Rose, the desperate and big-hearted agent, but...
The Mia Farrow character, you wouldn't...
But Mia Farrow character, and then you also think of someone like Helen Sinclair in Bullets Over Broadway, who you would never think of as being a character that Woody would have written, and yet these are all characters Woody has written. And there are innumerable ones. He writes gangsters, he writes intellectuals, he writes, you know, jocks and nerds and boxers and everything. And
hookers, let's not forget hookers.
Out of his personal curiosity, I think.
Those are some of my favorites, are the hookers. But you're talking about his characters and his ideas, and you've been fairly clear that Bullets Over Broadway, you guys co-wrote, but you seem to give him the lion's share of credit.
People, when they saw Bullets Over Broadway, and I have to correct a minor point in your introduction,
sure,
only out of fairness. Woody and I did the movie together, but I did not do the musical with him. That was his.
Oh, so you weren't collaborating on the libretto on that?
He did the libretto by himself.
Okay.
And it's because he doesn't need me. Nothing could have been friendlier, but I'm not bringing anything to it that he doesn't already have. And when Bullets the film came out, for some people, they thought, oh, it seems like a different, it's not like a regular Woody Allen movie, and they assumed that was because of me. But it isn't. I'm just telling you, I'm not being modest. We looked for ideas together. We found that idea. It was an idea of his. I loved it. But everything in it is his. It comes through the filter of his taste and intelligence.
Well, what did you contribute then? What was your part of Bullets Over Broadway, the movie?
I was a very supportive cheerleader. You know, he doesn't need... It's funny. I think he thought it would be interesting because he had done some collaborating early in his career with Mickey Rose and with Marshall Brickman. But he hadn't collaborated for a long, long time. And I think maybe there was just part of him that wondered, well, I wonder what that would be like again. And then I think he thought, yeah, I don't really need a collaborator. It couldn't have been a nicer experience. And I'll tell you this. He could have, because of his position and mine, lorded himself over me the entire time, giving me lectures on how he is a great filmmaker, blah, 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 and me as a lowly, lucky, blah, blah, blah. But he never did. He was always, if I said, I don't like this, he was always like, why? And he really wanted to know why. And if you had a good reason, that was the end of something. If you didn't have a good reason and he countered, then we went that way. But he never took advantage of his artistic superiority.
Well.
And he used his own intellect to pull out the best of what I had to offer.
So it does sound, though, that you were in the room. You were helping. You were saying yes, this, no, that. And you had probably lines of dialogue and ideas that you put in.
Yes, but I'm just saying it's really his piece. Occasionally when I see it, I just think... That was like, I forget, his 28th movie. I forget where that fits in the lineup. Now when I look at the whole thing, meaning at all he's done, you know, you look at a movie like Blue Jasmine.
Right.
Fantastic. Fantastic to me. One of his best films. And you think, that guy, it's impossible to believe. It's just that he has so much talent, you can't believe that guy that created Blue Jasmine
yeah.
is the same person, you know, which is a shattering... deeply observant, really smart drama. It could possibly have been written by the same person who wrote Bananas.
But also, over the years, we've seen Interiors, we've seen Match Point. So those are films where you go, oh, is that the same? Well, Interiors you knew. But Match Point was a very, very different thing. And it was still him, obviously.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's an extraordinary... He's got a lot of rooms in the house of his head.
And is he... I mean, he's almost 80 now. He's not slowing down. He's healthy. He's still...
He is 80 now, and he is definitely not slowing down. He's doing a series for Amazon.
Oh, right, yes.
He has a movie every year. The movie every year never stops. That's happening. But within it, you know, in one year he did the musical of Bullets. This year he's going to do the... I can't remember how many episodes it is, but 6, 8, I don't know, episodes of his series for Amazon, which he's just announced is going to co-star him. Miley Cyrus.
Wow.
So, no, he's indefatigable.
We don't have to get into the dark stuff, but I assume you believe everything that he says about his, you know, the relationship and the ensuing and yeah. All of that.
I think the most conclusive, you know, in the end, only the people who were there know what it is. But I have to say, if you read the piece that Woody wrote for the Times, I don't know if it was a year ago, and it has a title sort of like Woody Allen Answers or Woody Allen Defends Himself, his case seems so logically and unemotionally put, just a statement of facts. It seems not only persuasive, but decisive to me, conclusive.
I mean, because I grew up loving Woody Allen movies, loving his writing, loving his humor. And I don't want to believe the way people have to learn now to believe Bill Cosby's baggage, as it were. I don't want to believe it. So that's the situation of people who aren't close to him and friends the way you are. So that's
right.
Why, you know, we're
well,
kind of
I think
there.
The, you know, he didn't answer it or speak about it for a long time. And then he finally did. And I was deeply impressed by what he wrote. I hadn't ever doubted him myself, but I thought the gathering of the arguments and the facts and many times just a statement, the posing of a question, which just asks the reader or the public to use its common sense as he laid the information before it, as I say, I thought was very persuasive.
Well, one thing is, you know, you and your wife, you dine with him, and we haven't even talked about Sung-hee. What does she bring to him over these past 20 years? Has she brought him out of his shell? What has she done that's been good for his life and personality?
I think she has brought him out of his shell. She, you know, when I first knew Woody, it was before they were a couple, and he was very, very set in his ways. He's still set in his ways. But he was very set in his ways. He had only a certain number of restaurants he went to. I'm not saying he was in a rut, because I think he felt very comfortable that way. But then Sun-hee came along, and I think she thought, well, what about that restaurant? What about this place? What about that? And so I think it did kind of bring him out of his shell. He is a genuinely shy person, and I think she hasn't made that go away entirely, because he retains a certain amount of shyness, and he's certainly a very private person. But I think she's helped him become less shy.
Let me add, moving away from the personal, and I apologize for talking so much about Woody Allen, but you can understand why people would be interested in. And,
of course.
But moving towards the work and the art, and now you're saying that he was the book for the musical version of Bullets Over Broadway. You were
yes.
involved in the movie writing to some extent, but not at all in the musical. Did you see the musical? What did you think of it? I thought it was delightful. I thought it was funny. Why do you think audiences didn't materialize? Why were the reviews not what they hoped it would be?
You know, I honestly don't know. I did see it. I saw it a number of times, and I thought it was a great match between Woody and Susan Stroman, who directed it. I thought she did some of the best work I've ever seen of hers. I thought the numbers were dazzling and pleasing and delightful. I thought Santo's work, Santo Laposto, who did the sets, and William Ivy Long, I just thought all throughout the work was tremendous. It was, you know, it was a big jolly confection. Yeah, I can never make sense of why something finds an audience or doesn't, or
I think the critics blamed him for not finding a new person to write the score instead of using...
Yeah, you're right. Well, some people objected to that, but that seems a silly objection.
I know, right? I don't get it. I mean, well, you know, of all things, jukebox musicals are the most popular things now. Why not have a very funny book and pop in songs that really did play on a jukebox at one point?
You know, correct. And also, the songs are wonderful. I mean, you know, it seems to me the question should be not are they new or are they old, but are they good? And those were wonderful songs. I mean, you know, one of the greatest musicals ever made, the movie of Singing in the Rain.
Oh, yeah.
Those are all old songs. Those songs were written in the 20s. And they were ingeniously put together in that movie, just as a few years later the songs in The Bandwagon were ingeniously put in. So I think the question is never, new versus old is just good.
Well, yes,
I agree with you that people did. I think some people objected to that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but the other answer to that is, I mean, if it was just about having good songs, then every review that came along on Broadway, and they've had them about the Beach Boys, and they had a John Lennon musical and a Beatles. I mean, yeah, if it was just the songs and the songs were good, then that's all you'd have to do. Have really good singers sing good songs. Obviously, there's another quality in there.
Well, totally. You know, Rabbi, I wrote the book for the Carol King musical,
sure.
Beautiful, and one of the things we discovered early on is that just because the audience loved the songs, if the script didn't support them properly, it didn't work. The people go to unless you're going to a concert. If you're going to a concert, of course.
Right.
But if you're going to a show, there's some part of you in your brain that thinks, I need to be engaged with what's happening in front of me. I don't want people just singing songs at me and thinking that's going to make me happy because I've heard that song before. They want to be engaged in a story or amused by a story or touched by a story.
It's true. I mean, for every Jersey Boys where the script supports, and I'm not a huge Frankie Valli fan, but the Jersey Boys is a very fun, very well-written show, and so is Beautiful the Musical. I'm not the biggest Carole King fan, but I was like, oh, it's nice to hear these songs, but I was more interested in these two couples having a professional rivalry,
yes.
Musically.
Yes. I always think the challenge is, can you make the show work for people who don't know the music? You can't make the show work for people who don't like the music, because then that's not happening. But if they don't know the music, and then they come, the first thing they start paying attention to is the story. And if they get pulled into the story, then the songs work like genuine theater songs for them, because they're new to them.
Did the finding that thread, because, I mean, obviously the story is Carol King, she goes from being the housewife, da-da-da, to becoming her own person as a musician, etc. But that idea of these two warring, friendly warring couples working for Don Kirshner, etc. Where did that come to you in the process of writing the libretto and doing the interviews and research?
Well, you know, that came very early. It was one of the things they all told me, all four, because I interviewed all four of the songwriters, and they were always like, you could tell they are genuinely, affectionately devoted to each other, and they are genuinely competitive with each other. Mm. So even, 50 years later, you could ask Barry or Cynthia, or you could ask Carol and Jerry, you can talk about a song of theirs, and they'll say, he's sure the boy I love. And I say, how did that do? Number 7. Remember, 50 years later, it's number 7. It had a bullet. It didn't have a bullet. They were 6 places ahead of Carol and Jerry's song. They remember it very clearly. But what was so wonderful about them is that they really felt each team wanted to beat the other team, always. But they always kind of felt, well, if we can't beat them, they genuinely wanted the other team to succeed above anyone else except themselves.
It was
a really nice mix of the friendly and the competitive.
Can I ask, if we get the idea that Jerry Goffin was kind of eccentric, with drugs or not, and then other substances or not, what was he like when you were interviewing him fairly, as we know now, late in his life?
Right. I don't know that he was more eccentric than... Well, he was eccentric, yes, but... You know, all four of them, I loved Jerry, first of all. He was very, very, when I knew him, which was probably starting in his late 60s, he had a great quality of sweetness about him, meaning he just put out a kind of aura of gentle sweetness. Now, I don't think that was the aura that he always put out throughout his whole life. I think that was part of the aura he put out in his life. But earlier in his life, there was a lot of other stuff going on. I think he was quite a ladies' man. Women just were mad for him. They just loved him. And he was very competitive, and he held himself to a very, very high standard with the work. So that when they were starting out in the late 50s and in the early 60s, he and Carol, they both wanted this, but he was really hard on them to be the best. So that when someone came along, someone great came along, like Bob Dylan, that threw Jerry, who was a superb lyricist and a great artist at what he did, that threw him into a terrible crisis because he thought, well, we may be good, but we're not as good as that. So if there was something better, that kind of tortured him because he wanted to be the best.
That's how I feel whenever I go to another shul and hear another rabbi give a good sermon.
Is that true?
Oh, I burn with jealousy. Oh, my God. Well, I have to take 10
it's a good
Pepsi.
Thing. We want to be the best at what we can do. So, I mean, some people do. Not all people do. But, you know, you see someone doing what you do better than you do it. It's both inspiring and enraging, you know, because you think, why am I not doing that? But then you see where the bar is, too, and you think, well, I got to shoot for that. I got to try for that.
Now, you also, of course, had to interview Carole King a lot of times. And speaking of people who are shy, you say she is pretty self-effacing in a lot of ways. Yes? No?
Oh, yes. No, no. She's... But what was interesting in my experiences with Carole was this. She had resisted doing the show for a long time. She had finally decided to do it. And we sat down, and she was in the middle of writing her own book, her autobiography. We sat down, and I asked her everything I could think of. And I, you know, if I had just met her at a dinner party, I would never have asked her any of those questions because they were so personal and probing. But because my job was essentially as a biographer, I had to ask her everything. And she opened up fully. The interviews were very emotional. There were a lot of tears. There's a lot of old stuff that I don't think she had talked about a lot. And funnily enough,
yeah,
when her autobiography came out, I thought, oh, I can't wait to read her book, assuming that there were going to be more details than she had given me. And in fact, in the area of her life that my show covers, she'd given me all the best things. She had, I think it was very hard for her to write about that time because it was a joyful time in many ways and a painful time in many ways. And she spent a very little of the book on it, especially in an emotional way. That's not in there at all. I think she finds it better to let someone else say it for her. Not in her music. Of course, she lets her music, you know, she says what she wants in her music. But in that case, at least in this part of her life, she seemed to entrust me with that. And I treated it like a trust.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's nothing embarrassing to her in the musical at all, but it tells some truth about marriage and about, you know, what she went through. And there's a reason that, you know, she was almost afraid to see it for a period of time or promote it. I mean, they got her on the Tonys, they finally got her on TV and singing with Jesse Mueller and blah, blah, blah. But it took some doing.
Yes, it did. You know, when she gave us the rights, you know, there was a period while I was writing, the songwriters had the right of approval at a certain point, so I had to turn in a script, and they had to decide whether they were going to go ahead with it or not. And the way we did that was we had a reading, meaning where we had actors and the musicians, and they came and sang and read the show. And after that reading, which she left halfway through, she left in the middle, and everyone was like, oh, no, she hates it, she hates it. Well, in fact, what it was she left because it was too emotional for her. You know, it's a show, it's not only about the breakup of her marriage, it's about many happier things as well, but that's
course.
A big part of what it's about. And, you know, she told us later, she said, it all seemed so real, I couldn't watch it again. You know, for her, that's not really entertainment, you know, to see her marriage dissected that way and to think about what her choices had been and to relive that pain. But she could tell that we were telling the story honestly and that we weren't demonizing Jerry, but we weren't apologizing for, you know, we were trying to really tell it the way they told it to me. Well, she said, you can have the rights, but I'm not coming. I'm just telling you, I'm not coming. Not only, I can't watch it, and furthermore, I don't want people to watch me watch it.
Wow.
And we just kept thinking, well, surely she'll come. And then we tried out the show in San Francisco. She didn't come. We had opening night on Broadway. She didn't come. Once she didn't come to the opening night on Broadway, I thought, well, I'm beginning to think she's not coming. But then she kept hearing from people who loved the show and who kept saying, it's so wonderful, you have to go. So she decided to come, but she came in disguise.
Wow.
It's like I Love Lucy. She wore a wig, she wore a scarf, she wore glasses, and she and her daughter came and sat in the house, and then just 5 minutes before the end of the show, it was all organized. The cast had no idea she was there, nothing. She snuck backstage, and in the middle of the curtain call, she came out. And, Rabbi, I want to tell you, that house, they went crazy. And somebody called out. It was the time of the year when the cast raises money for Equity Fights AIDS. And the cast... cast called out, I mean, not the cast, someone in the audience called out, please sing something. And she said, well, if you'll make a good enough donation to the Equity Fights AIDS cause, I will. And someone bid $30,000.
Gewalt!
30,000 smackers. And she sang, You've Got a Friend. And she later brought the cast in to sing it with her.
I can't tell you what I would do for $30,000. There are things that are not legal in New York State that I would do for $30,000.
Well, that's what she did for $30,000.
Well, I have to I have to apologize to my listeners because we're having so much fun talking with Douglas McGrath, the book writer, the guy about the Beautiful, the musical. You only have a couple more minutes with us, so I have to rush through a couple of quick more questions if I can.
Okay.
Please. A little bit about... You did a documentary about Mike Nichols, and I'm wondering what's something really interesting that you didn't expect to find out about him.
I did not realize that Mike Nichols, because the documentary starts next week on HBO, I didn't realize that Mike was a refugee from Nazi Germany. I did not realize that he had come with his family when he was only 7 and his was only 4. And they came over on the Bremen without either parent. And, his father was already here and his mother was behind. And when he arrived here, he spoke no English. The only phrase he spoke was, I don't speak English, please don't kiss me. Because all on the boat right over, all the ladies would pass the little boys and they'd bend down and kiss them. But what happened was he got here, and he only spoke German. And I'll tell you what it taught me about him. He knew, because when you're a kid, you want to fit in. That's what you want. You want to fit in. You don't want to stand out. And so to do that, you have to figure out what everybody else is like and who the successful people are and who the funny people are. And he studied what everybody was like, and he learned how to, fit in. But in that studying, I think he developed an extraordinary skill of observation that later served him as a writer.
A director, of course, too.
Yes, and as an improvisational actor, and then as a director. So that was a great surprise to me. I hadn't known that about him.
Now, another person that you did a documentary about, and I have to ask this because, Jerry Weintraub, the late producer, and what's interesting things you found out about him, and did he ever talk about Chabad?
Oh, yes. A lot about that. A lot. Everything I found out about Jerry was interesting. He's the most interesting person I think I've ever met. He was an absolute force of nature. And the greatest thing about him, in a way, was that everybody, well, I don't know if everybody did, but I loved Jerry, my wife loved Jerry, my son loved Jerry. He had hundreds and thousands of friends. Everybody, all the gang loved him. But no one loved him more than Jerry.
Oh.
Jerry just loved being Jerry Weintraub. And it didn't come off, if you were his friend, it did not come off as conceit. It came off as the most wonderful thing, which is just a certain kind of joy.
I have to tell you, if you have a moment, my favorite Jerry Weintraub moment. I've never met the man personally, but there was one Chabad telethon that he not only produced, but he would co-host for several years. I don't know if you watch it every year, but he would get on every year and do his spiel, and you could almost never get him off camera. Finally, they'd bring the other rabbi, Rabbi Kuhnin, on, and then the show would go on. But he would make his pitch, and for people who don't know, Chabad is generally about helping people of all races and creeds get off drugs and alcohol, kick their addictions and stuff. But this particular Chabad telethon happened, he had just had a car accident, and like that week. And he was okay, but he had sort of a broken arm, and his arm was in a sling. And he was up there introducing the show, slurring every other word. And at one point, he's like, I have to apologize because I'm on a cocktail of painkillers and Stoli. And I'm looking at this, and I'm like, oh my God, this is a telethon to kick booze and drugs. It was the most beautiful thing I ever saw. I was screaming at the television. Well, I do that anyway, but
the wonderful thing about him was he as someone in my documentary says, he has no governor on his brain. He has no filter. It just, whatever he's thinking comes out. And in a way, It must have been a relief. You know, the rest of us, or at least me, I spent a lot of my day thinking, oh, don't say that. Well, maybe split the difference. But a lot of that. And it's tiring. Not Jerry. He never had to do that. He never worried about it. And he's so truthful that I think people who often disagreed with him didn't mind because they knew they weren't being having the wool pulled over their eyes.
We are talking, by the way, with the very delightful Douglas McGrath. Before I let you go, it's only fair to ask you, I mean, all these things we're talking about are things that you have already done, things you've already directed. You are talking, well, the reason we're also talking about the Carole King beautiful musical is that there's a documentary not directed by you, but you're a talking head in the film. But yeah. What are you working on these days? Is there that movie Brooklyn Bridge? Is that happening? What are you working on?
We are in the midst of casting my movie about the building of the Brooklyn Bridge.
Ooh, do you need a rabbi?
Sorry?
Do you need a rabbi? I need you. I can do an under five.
Yeah. So let me reread the script. Okay. Not yet, but we may.
Oh, okay, great.
We may, you never know. So that's what I'm doing next.
And Brooklyn Bridge is about the building of the Brooklyn Bridge. You got Daniel Radcliffe, I think, and Ben Kingsley are cast already. Is that true?
So far, so good. It's about, and you know, it's about the Roebling family.
Okay. I've never Roebled, so I don't know. Yes.
Oh, no, the Roeblings, they were amazing. That's really the heart of the story, was this family of German-born, the father was German-born, but Americans, who the father, John Roebling, was the greatest engineer of the 19th century, which was a century of great engineers. And it's an incredible story of, you know, it touches on everything because it's about how an American icon, which is the Brooklyn Bridge, is built naturally entirely by immigrants. The stories of heroism and funnily enough, romance in the story are incredible. So I'm really looking forward to making it.
Oh, great. So I guess all your energies are concentrated on that, or do you also have, are you one of these people like, oh, I'm also working on a play, I've also got this. What else, what other iron in the fire, as it were?
I don't have that many energies. I'm a one rock up the mountain kind of guy.
Well, let me ask one last, I know, are they calling you or are you calling, I know you have another interview, right?
I do. Do you have a 1 minute question? Meaning that we can finish in 1 minute?
I think we can with Douglas McGrath. And the question is, people may not know that you spent one season during the Dumanian years of Saturday Night Live. What was the best and the worst sketch you were involved with writing during that one Saturday Night Live season?
That's a there almost was no best sketch, though I have a fond memory of a sketch that my friend Patty Marks, who was a writing partner of mine at the show, she and I wrote a sketch about the Mona Lisa, who had been having an affair with a guard at the Louvre, and they were breaking up. That was a very fun sketch to write. There is no possible way I can select the worst sketch, because every time I would focus, just maybe narrow it down to two or three, I could think of six others.
Thank you, Walt. Well, maybe that'll be for our next conversation. You can narrow it down to three and tell us about all of them. Because I would love to invite you back to the neighborhood. It's been a delight talking with Douglas McGrath. Please go see Beautiful the Musical on Broadway. Please watch the documentary about Beautiful that's coming to PBS American Masters this week. And look for Brooklyn Bridge coming to the movies in a year or two. Much health.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Shalom to you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.